What to do, Shawty?
Murder stories lull the baby to sleep, okay?
We're a little weird at first, but you get used to us.
We're your favorite sisters.
Except for if you have your own sisters, probably.
No, but I'm gonna be, you know, your favorite.
We're gonna bump them bitches out of there.
Kick rocks, other sisters. No one likes you.
Kick rocks.
Wake the fuck up or shut the fuck up. No one wants to hear about that.
You just told them I like to poop. It'll be an adventure, and we hope that you come along for the ride. Please subscribe.
You'll make the baby cry if you don't.
Yeah, don't upset Ethan by not subscribing. That's just rude.
Welcome to Suspicious,
a podcast with two sisters
who are a bit obsessed with true crime,
unsolved mysteries,
extraterrestrials,
and all things strange.
Stay a while.
Let's get weird. Hey guys, welcome back to Suspicious.
Hey. Hi there. Hello. Hey, guess what?
No.
I got a new mic.
You do. I realized
after our last recording session where somehow Jennifer sounded like she was in water.
Yeah, so there was some kind of
seafood weird murders.
Seafood murders? Google was like, "What the fuck are you looking for?" Welcome back. If you didn't listen to last episode, you should.
Unless you
have a seafood allergy.
You're pretty funny on it for once. I thought.
I think we're always funny. Anyways.
But we told stories and we did accents and sang songs-ish. So
accents were terrible. So look forward to that.
Songs were terrible as well. So we tried.
Also look forward to that.
And then if you loved the sound of being in a bubble in the ocean, then you'd love the second part of the story.
Okay, my audio files were corrupted and I did my best.
Yeah, we had audio issues. Anyway, well.
Hopefully this episode is much clearer.
Thanks for joining us. Please subscribe. Be our friend.
Like and subscribe. So, let's dive right on into it.
So this time, I've had this story for a while. Because since we started releasing later and changing, well, since we started changing our release schedule, I've had this one for a little bit.
They don't need to know that.
No, oh. Well, no, because they do, because then I don't want them to think I just copied someone else who came out with it. Remember when I texted you and I was like, oh, this other podcast just, I heard one on it.
Yeah. I never care about that because I'm like, I'm not the first person to tell this story and I'm not going to be the last person to tell this story in any story. Unless, like, we just found a murder that happened in the moment.
Yeah.
And reported on it.
So, my story today is about the mysterious death of Thelma Todd. Old-timey actress. Have you heard of her?
That's why I like that I can basically just see your nose and lips.
Have you heard about her? Do you know about this story?
I do not.
Are you sure?
I don't know that.
You don't know anything.
Fuck off. You're such a bitch. I know things. I just don't always know that I know things. You know what I mean?
No. It's a horse laugh every time. It's the old man wheeze.
Oh, God, you're so mean. I'm sure I've probably heard of Thelma Todd and probably seen her pictures, but I don't know that I necessarily know the story of her demise.
Okay, well, great. Let me tell you. Head wiggle. Okay, so Thelma Todd was born in Lawrence, Massachusetts, July 29th, 1906. She was born to John Shaw Todd and Mary Elizabeth Edwards.
Oh, I thought it was like John, comma, Shaw, comma, Todd, comma, and Mary Elizabeth Edwards.
My in a band.
Damn. It was an orgy.
They don't know who the dad was, no. John. They list all the names always in these like old timey stories. They all have like full friggin' names. So your butt.
Don't put needles in them.
No, that was needle dick.
I know, but still, don't put needles anywhere in your genital area.
It was alcohol in your butt.
Oh, that's right. That one too. If you don't know, listen to the last episode.
Hey, listen to our last episode. Okay. Now for reals, on with my story. Okay. So Thelma had an older brother, William, who was born in 1903, and he died in an unspecified accident in 1910 when William was 7 and Thelma was 4. John Todd was originally an upholsterer from Ireland. He said to have been very abusive and very distant and not loving at all. And I saw it said that he was a corrupt politician, but I'm not sure because I only saw that one place. But
interesting.
He wasn't very nice, apparently. And he died in 1920 at the age of 55. So Alice Todd, Thelma's mom, was an immigrant from Canada. And she was described... Blame Canada. She was described as a very manipulative person. She would force Thelma to do stuff that she didn't want to do. Thelma, when she was younger, was a very bright student, described as being very smart and funny, and she wanted to actually to be a school teacher. So after she graduated high school in 1923, she enrolled in college called Lowell Normal School. However, as stated above, Alice forced Thelma to do stuff she didn't want to, so she actually forced Thelma to enter beauty pageants in her late teens. Thelma won the title of Miss Massachusetts in 1925. She went on to represent her home state in the Miss America pageant. She didn't win, but she did win the Eye of a Talent Scout from Paramount Studios, who happened to be at the pageant. And then this would be the thing that would kick off Thelma's career in the movies. Thelma never wanted to be an actress, but she did excel at it. She was described as being very sexy, a gorgeous peroxide blonde. She got the nicknames Ice Cream Blonde and Hot Toddy. She was wisecracking and had an outrageous sense of humor. She was moral to some degree. We'll see, depending on, you know, how you define moral. But she also had like a very strong character. She was described as a cross between now Goldie Hawn and Farrah Fawcett, but it said that she was far more popular for her time than either of those two were. It's also said that she had like a Marilyn Monroe quality or feel to her, and similarity to Marilyn, Thelma just wanted someone to care and love and respect her.
Don't we all?
I just want to be loved
by
you.
Me too, Thelma.
And you and nobody else. Will do. That's terrible. We're gonna edit most of this shit out.
I'm gonna leave that in for show.
Oh wow, you have such a big notepad.
I was like, what are you gonna say?
I don't know. Thelma was also reported to have lots of love for alcohol, drugs, and men. Thelma constantly sought father figures or father surrogates with the men she chose to date. Lonnie Anderson said that she always picked the wrong guys. An ex-producer, Frank von Zernick, said that she was drawn to men who were extremely dangerous, and that was her Achilles heel. Playing with fire was a personality problem. She was abused, mishandled, and ultimately it cost her life. So I'm not spelling a thing out, obviously, because we know she died. Because it was
Duh.
So early in Thelma's career, it was during the silent film era. And Thelma had numerous supporting roles, but these roles gave her very little acting chances. So once the talkies came out, which were like the names for the films with actual sound and speaking roles, she quickly expanded her role in these films, and when Hal Roach signed her to appear with stars like Harry Langdon, Charlie Chase, and Laurel and Hardy, her career just took off from there. Hal Roach was a movie studio executive, and he was reported to have been abusive to her as well. He invented something called the potato clause, which was said to be because Thelma had a weight problem, which if you see her pictures, well, if you see her pictures, she clearly was not overweight at all and didn't have any kind of weight problem. She was very like slender. But anyway, in this contract that she signed, there was a clause in it that said that she could gain no more than 5 pounds or she would be fired from the studio. So that was the potato clause.
That's straight up bullshit. Like if they did that shit nowadays, could you imagine?
They have other wording stuff for it. Yeah. They still have that shit. That's fucking nuts. Because of this contract and this clause, Thelma's mom, Alice, started to give Thelma diet pills. Thelma soon became addicted to these diet pills and she also continued to drink a lot, which helped keep her weight down. In 1931, Thelma starred in her own series of between 17 to 27 minute slapstick comedy shorts. And these were a very big hit and boosted her popularity. She also starred in a movie called Corsair, which was directed by Roland West. And we'll get back to Roland West in a little bit.
Is that motherfucker involved?
So he was a director. And in 1932, Thelma married Pat DeCicco. I don't know how to say his last name. It's DeCicco? DiCicco. So Pat, we're just going to call him Pat. He was an agent from with Underworld Connections, and he would beat Thelma a lot. Finally, though, Thelma got fed up with the abuse and with Pat, and she divorced him in 1934, so 2 years later. Thelma kept making movies, though. She became highly regarded as a Capital Film comedian. She became highly regarded as a capable film comedian.
Capable. She can wear caps and she can cap on your ass.
She can wear caps on caps with bonnets and
she
bills.
She can put the cap in your ass, too. She's capable.
She liked all the hats.
No cap.
So she was a capable film comedian. She had a wide circle of friends and associates, and she kept very busy with her social life. She was thriving after her divorce from Pat, and at some point, it wasn't really clear from the stuff that I read when, but she became romantically involved with Roland West,
the director.
So now it should be noted also that West was married to a lady named Jewel Carmen, and Thelma and West, when Thelma and West became involved. And it also appears that Jewel did know about this, but she didn't seem to really care about the liaisons between Thelma and her husband. Mm-hmm. So maybe they had some kind of like arrangements. In August of 1934, Thelma opened a restaurant called Thelma Todd's Sidewalk Cafe. This was at 17575 Pacific Coast Highway in Pacific Palisades, California. So bougie. She co-owned the restaurant with Roland and his wife, Jewel. The Sidewalk Cafe was described as a very posh place and became the watering hole for Hollywood celebs, tourists, politicians, and gangsters. Thelma lived above the cafe in an apartment, and there were plans in the works later in 1935 to expand the cafe and to add a large room to be named the Joyous Room, where the new room would basically be glittery for dancing and dining. So after her divorce from Pat, Thelma swore off booze, but the night that she met Lucky Luciano at the Coconut Grove nightclub, Lucky insisted that she have some champagne with him, and she refused, and he asked, and she refused. But again, Lucky would not take no for an answer, and he kept insisting, and eventually Thelma caved, and Lucky ended up pouring basically a whole bottle of champagne down her throat that night. So she consumed a whole bottle by herself. But from then on, Lucky and Thelma became kind of an item, and they started seeing each other more regularly. And to maintain control over Thelma, he supplied her with even more potent amphetamines than the diet pills that she had been previously taking. Thelma then became hooked on these amphetamines. And besides becoming hooked on these from Lucky, she became addicted to the excitement and the danger of being with a gangster. So if you don't know who Lucky is, Lucky Luciano was a gangster and a mobster and reported psychopath. He was involved in prostitution, gambling, and extortion in L.A. Lucky and Thelma's relationship was torturous. Lucky would be verbally and physically abusive to Thelma. Lucky was not just interested in Thelma because she was one of the most beautiful and successful women in Hollywood at the time, but more than that, he wanted to control her restaurant, and he wanted to set up an illegal gambling operation on the unused third floor of the building. His goal was to take over and take over a movie studio by getting one of their powerful executives to be in huge gambling debts to him. Now, while Thelma was clearly a punching bag for her abusive men, including tolerating, quote unquote, Lucky's beatings on her, she was strong-willed and she was a businesswoman, and she actually did stand up to Lucky when it came down to him demanding to be involved in her to involve her in his illegal casino. She wasn't having any of it at all, and she loved her cafe. She took so much pride into it and wasn't going to let anyone or anything mar that reputation. The cafe was the first thing that she ever owned on her own, and it's the only thing that really gave her a sense of freedom. Okay, so now we're going to jump a little bit in time, and we're going to go to the morning of December 16th, 1935. Thelma's maid, May Whitehead, found Thelma in the garage of Jewel Carmen, which was Roland's wife, and she's also the co-owner of the cafe. She found her in the garage slumped over her Lincoln convertible, slumped over the front wheel, and it was reported that there was coagulated blood on Thelma's features, including it being stained over her mauve and silver gown and on her mink coat. Also, it's reported that her hair was in disarray. So May, after finding Thelma, called R.H.W. Schaefer, Thelma's cafe manager. Side note, Thelma's cafe was actually about a block down the hill from the garage.
So, well, you might have mentioned it before, you just mentioned it, but I didn't put two and two together, that her business partner in the cafe was the wife of the man she was sleeping with?
No, both of them. I said it before too, but yeah, she co-owned her restaurant with Roland and his wife.
Damn. Okay.
And they lived about a block up from the cafe, and she lived at the cafe. So they lived a block away. So May, after finding Thelma, called RHW, her cafe manager, which was about a block away down the hill from the garage. And then the cafe manager showed up. Then when he showed up, then he contacted Dr. J.P. Sampson. And it was then J.P. Sampson who finally called the police.
What the fuck?
Dr. Sampson said he didn't find any evidence of bodily injury and expressed that he believed Thelma had been dead for at least 12 hours. Thelma was noted to...
Wait, if there was no bodily injury, then where was the blood from?
So, I don't know. But, okay.
That's part of the weirdness of it.
Yeah, so it was also noted, though, that she still had all her jewels on, her neck and her wrists. Her purse was still there untouched, and she still had her mink coat on. Police investigators showed up. So here's the series of events before Thelma was found. So now we're going to backtrack slightly. Mm-hmm. So hopefully it's not too confusing. So on Saturday, before Thelma was found, December 14th, she left her apartment shortly after 8 p.m. to attend a party. The party was held at Trocadero. It was a very popular Hollywood restaurant. And this party was actually hosted by an entertainer, Stanley Limpino, and his daughter, who was also an actress, Ida. Pat, Thelma's ex-husband, apparently was also at this party. And Thelma and Pat had a very brief exchange, which Pat later described as unpleasant, but friends said she was still in good spirits and, you know, just kind of like, they probably had a couple words and they were done.
Yeah.
But while at the party, Thelma made a fun wager with her friends, some of her friends there, joking, saying, I bet you a dinner that you won't come to my place tomorrow. and her friends happily agreed, "You're on." So when Thelma decided to leave the party in the early hours of Sunday, December 15th, she was driven home by her chauffeur, Ernest O. Peters. Ernest told the police that Miss Todd told him while she was en route to the cafe that she had an appointment at 1:55 a.m. No one, including the police, are sure of what this statement meant or like who she was having an appointment with or whatever. Thelma was reported to return to the cafe in her apartment, which was above, again, the cafe, about 3 a.m. She tried to get into her apartment, but she discovered that she didn't have the key, and so she walked up the hill to the garage with her Lincoln convertible in it, located at the West's residence, about 400 feet or so away from the garage. And when police questioned Roland and Jewel about the night, Roland said he first was quoted saying that he had locked Thelma out of the place, which may have caused her to seek refuge and warmth in the car. But then he told police that if Thelma had returned home, that it is his opinion that she failed to wake him or Jewel, and that she probably returned to her home. He said that Todd was very considerate and independent. And he did get a call from a Sid Gauman, a Sid Grauman, who was at the party with Thelma. And Sid called Roland shortly before 2 a.m. to tell him that Thelma was on her way home. Roland also said that he had woken up because his dogs were barking Sunday morning, but he did not go and investigate. There is no alarms that went off to Schaefer, the cafe manager, or any of Thelma's friends when Thelma didn't make an appearance at the cafe on Sunday, as she frequently was absent over the weekends. She just kind of came and go when she wanted. So her friends from the party on Saturday showed up Sunday to call on Thelma's bet, and they were told that Thelma had not been seen at her place that day. So her friends still stayed at the cafe, and they did have dinner on Thelma's dime because, you know, the bet was set. So that was the bet. Police also then interviewed a watchman who makes the rounds in the vicinity of the Roland and Jules residence and the cafe. And he was doing his rounds about 6 a.m. on Sunday, but he didn't see anything. And he told police that he believed Thelma would go into the garage to stay warm and wait for him to do his rounds, where he would then be able to let her into her apartment above the cafe. Police found that the key was in the ignition of the car, which indicated that the car was running until the garage filled with carbon monoxide gas, which would then cause the car to shut off due to the lack of oxygen. Her cause of death was ruled as being from carbon monoxide poisoning. LAPD first concluded that Thelma's death was accidental and a result from either her warming up the car to drive it or keeping it on and using it as a heater to keep her warm. Thelma's body was taken to see, was taken to the,
Sinai?
No. She was taken to the Todd and Leslie Mortuary in Santa Monica, where the cursory examination was made by a representative of the coroner's office, after which Coroner Nance ordered an immediate postmortem of her body be taken to at the county morgue. So now on December 18th, 1935, there was a coroner's inquest that was held. An autopsy surgeon, A.P. Wagner, testified that there were no marks of violence anywhere upon her or within her body, and that she only had a superficial contusion to the lower lip. There was a gold inlay, which on the previous Saturday was placed on her teeth, which then was knocked loose in her mouth and apparently cut her lip when she slumped over the steering wheel. So according to the police theory, so they're thinking she hit the steering wheel, it knocked her little thing, her like inlay thing off, and it cut her in the lip. That's what they thought. However, there's many informal accounts that there were greater signs of injury to her. Not only as, like I previously said, where it was reported that she had coagulated blood on her features and her fancy gown and her mink coat and that her hair was in a mess, but It was also reported that Thelma had a broken nose and she had bruises around her throat. Plus, she had two cracked ribs. But these were unable to be explained. A grand jury probe was held to determine if Thelma was murdered, but the grand jury concluded that there was no foul play evidence. The death was ruled as accidental with possible suicide tendencies.
So the broken ribs and stuff was notated in the coroner's report or no?
Believe so.
That's just what I just saw. It was after the fact.
Yeah, when it was reported. So I don't know. I don't think it's official. It's obviously not officially reported, but it was like, I think people who examined her possibly said after the fact.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So they ruled it basically accidental with possible suicide tendencies. Now, suicide was widely disputed, even by the cops who were there, because there was no suicide note. There was no motives for her suicide. Thelma's mom, Alice, stated that Thelma had recently found out that she had a heart ailment and was seeking treatment for that and applying for insurance. Police also rejected the theory of suicide when they found out that Thelma had more than 100 Christmas presents wrapped and addressed, ready to be sent out in her house. And she also had the expansion of in the works to expand her cafe. And she just begun work on a new picture. In addition to not believing Thelma committed suicide, there were reports also that they got a little bit after her death that would confound them even more. So one report was from Mrs. Wallace Ford. Mrs. Ford was a friend of Thelma. Her husband was an actor. And Mrs. Ford told the cops that about 4 p.m. on Sunday, December 15th, she got a call from Thelma in which she had been invited to a cocktail party at the Ford's home. She informed Mrs. Ford that she was on her way there with a friend. There was also a report from an unnamed waiter that he had seen Thelma drive past his restaurant on Hollywood Boulevard, and she was in her car, and this was about 2 p.m. on Sunday, December 15th. And if you remember, Dr. J.P. Sampson said Thelma had been dead for almost 12 hours. So police also found out that Thelma had so that was the extent of that piece. Like, two people said that they'd seen her after she was reported or supposed to be dead. Police had found out that Thelma had also received several extortion notes in the past few in the months before her death. And these notes threatened her with death if she didn't pay $10,000. There was two men who were arrested in the past 3 months for these notes, and they were in New York, though. The case was closed by the Homicide Bureau. Alice, Thelma's mom, was her sole heir, and oddly, before Thelma's death, she had announced to friends that she planned to build a mansion. So that's kind of odd. Thelma's memorial service was held at Pierce Brothers Mortuary in LA. Only a few people viewed Thelma's body during the service. They included her mother, her physician, and the following close friends: Sally Ehlers, Zazu Pitts, and Catherine Hunter. And Catherine Hunter was the secretary of Charlie Chaplin. Thelma was cremated after. And it should be noted that Thelma's last movie role was The Bohemian Girl, which was a full-length comedy that featured Laurel and Hardy. Before she died, she had finished all of her scenes, but producer Hal Roach had all of her scenes reshot and replaced her, and replaced all of the dialogue, or all her dialogue was deleted, and he only limited her appearance to one musical number in the movie. So that's also kind of odd.
Interesting.
In her short career, though, Thelma Todd had appeared in 120 films and shorts in between 1926 and 1935, so in 10 years. 11 years. When she died, her films included Monkey Business, Horse Feathers, and Speak Easily. She also was honored with a star on the Walk of Fame. And then after Thelma's mom, Alice, died in 1969, Thelma's remains removed and placed in Alice's casket, and they were both buried together in a family plot in Bellevue Cemetery in their hometown of Lawrence, Massachusetts. And that is the disputed mystery death of Thelma Todd, because no one thinks she actually
just died from carbon monoxide.
Yeah, or killed herself or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, for sure. I definitely don't think that it was a suicide. It didn't sound like...
I think
like
she
it
probably...
would be that. Like, she had plans. Like...
Yeah, I think she probably, like...
I guess it could have been carbon monoxide.
I wonder if Roland beat her up and then knocked her out and then turned the car on and left it in there and then...
Or some... Yeah, something. Because... Yeah, if there was reports that she had, like, broken ribs and stuff, not those official reports, well, obviously, but if people who saw
even
her
blood
body...
on her face, yeah.
Yeah.
Blood on her face, like, and hair and her clothes.
Yeah, like, a little lip cut wouldn't have made blood go everywhere.
No.
Interesting.
Yeah.
We need to do a seance and have and talk to her. I got a Ouija board pillow. We can use that.
No.
Think it would work?
No, not doing it.
I'm just kidding. I wouldn't fuck with that. Interesting.
So yeah, let me know what you think. Do you think it was murder? Do you think it was accidental? I think it was murder. My thought.
It was probably murder. I think so.
I think Roland murdered her. Because it was at his house. She probably went up there to meet him anyway. Might have gotten in an argument. I mean, it doesn't say no one recorded it, but... He could have gotten an argument. He could have just, like, went a little snappy and then beat her. And then...
Or it could have been the wife, too, right? Because she was maybe actually really angry that she was fucking with her husband.
Maybe.
You know what's funny? Because I'm an idiot. When you were telling the story and you're like, oh, yeah, they're from Lawrence, Massachusetts. And I was like, my story's from Massachusetts. And I was like, oh, yeah, because I picked it so that it would tie into your story.
All right there, idiot. What's your story?
This is going to be the story of Alfred Gaynor. Have you heard of him?
No.
Don't Google his face. You always cheat.
What?
Because you're always a cheater.
I just want to
know. And
then
you know things. Then you know things before I tell them who.
Okay. Anyway, go. Okay.
Okay. So Alfred Gaynor. But I'm not going to start with the details on Alfred Gaynor. I'm going to start with Loretta Daniels. So Loretta Daniels is a 38-year-old woman living in Springfield, Massachusetts. And she lived in the city her whole life and was the youngest of 11 siblings. So her parents got busy. And she was said to be very petite. She was only 4'11 in height and was known around town and her friends as Little Bit.
Oh, I thought you said Little Bitch.
Little Bitch? No, Little Bit. Because she was so
was
tiny.
Was she in a little gang? A little bit.
A little bit. No, she wasn't in a gang. She wasn't in a gang, but...
That's my homegirl, a little bit.
She wasn't in a gang, but she was from Springfield, Massachusetts, which, you know, there's areas of it that are very, like, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, poor areas, you know, and so...
Oh, you mean like we grew up? In the ghetto.
In the ghetto. So where am I? Oh, she was the type of woman that was described as always happy, always smiling, and really always having a positive outlook on life. A very much glass half full type of person.
So not like me.
Opposite of us. She was very close with her older sister, who acted as more of a mother figure to her. And they were so close that even in adulthood, they would talk on the phone every day. Uh-huh. So what'd you say?
I said,
gross. So towards the end of January of 1998, her sister had not heard from her, which was, again, very strange because they talked every day. So she called around to see if anyone had seen or heard from her. And a friend of hers, Dolores, indicated that she had run into Loretta the night before with a male friend, but everything seemed fine. So a second day passed with no word from Loretta, and her sister began to worry. Her and other members of the family went to talk to her friends, but none of them had seen her. A third day passed and still no word. Loretta shared a bank account with her sister, and so the sister went to the bank to see, you know, maybe she skipped town for some reason and just didn't tell anybody. But there was no withdrawals and no other transactions to the bank. That night, her sister had a disturbing vision. And she woke up in the middle of the night and saw Loretta sitting Indian style in the corner of the room, reaching out her hand to try to grab to her sister. obviously this was just a vision. It wasn't actually Loretta. So in the morning, she just had a really unsettled feeling and called Springfield Police Department to file a missing persons report. So on February 2nd of 1998, before the investigators could really look into the matter, a man walking downtown located the body of a female, partially undressed, in an alley near Mason Square by the post office. The man called the police, and while waiting for them to arrive, another resident, a minister, covered the woman's exposed body. And then when the investigators did arrive, they determined it appeared to be manual strangulation, and that was later confirmed by the coroner as the cause of death. Her mostly naked body was positioned in an unusual fashion, but her boots were set orderly next to her. She was sexually assaulted and strangled, and there was no defensive wounds located anywhere on her person. Now, Loretta's nephew was at home watching a news report about a body found in the downtown area, and he just had a sinking feeling that over time, no, and he just had a sinking feeling wash over him that this was the body of his aunt. So the whole family made their way down to the police station and later were able to identify the body as Loretta Daniels. The investigators canvassed the area looking for any possible witnesses, but no one was able to give any details on what might have happened or who might have committed this crime. Now, later during the autopsy of Loretta's body, they discovered that deep in her throat was a sock, likely her own, that had seminal fluid on it. However, at this time, they had no suspect and no one to compare the sample with. And since this was in the late 90s, forensics and DNA profiling was still in the beginning stages, and there wasn't like a huge database like there is now for them to just compare it to. So they kind of had to wait for suspects to come in and test against it. Now, a few of the detectives on the case began to realize that the murder of Loretta Daniels seemed oddly familiar. In fact, there were two recent deaths within the prior few months that occurred in Springfield and had a lot of similarities, letting them know that they may have a serial murderer on their hands. So 3 months earlier, in November of 1997, and just blocks away from where Loretta's body was found, there was a homicide on Spring Street. The body of a woman with no ID on her was located again in a state of undress just outside of an alley. The body was later identified as Danielle Taylor. She had been bound and gagged, which made the investigators think it had a sadomasochistic qualification to it. And upon the autopsy of Danielle, they located a tissue shoved down her throat that also had seminal fluid on it, like in the case of Loretta Daniels. Again, there was no witnesses to this crime. A week after they discovered Danielle Taylor, another body was found, this time 38-year-old Amanda Lawson. She was found in her home, just two blocks away from the police station. Amanda was a single mother and lived with her son, who was a minor at the time. She was raped and manually strangled. And her body was left in a position that her minor son would find her in the home. When the investigators were processing the crime scene, they located underneath her body a sock that again contained seminal fluid. There was also evidence that there was postmortem sexual relations with all of these victims. Detectives now, realizing that there was likely the same predator involved in all three crimes, sent off all of the items with DNA fluids for testing. However, again, DNA testing was still in the beginning stages, and these tests took a while to come back with any results. The community of Springfield, Massachusetts was reeling and looking for answers, and detectives found it interesting that there was no defensive wounds located on any of the victims. There was no witnesses to any of these crimes, so the investigators began to rely on tips that were coming in left and right. But they received mostly vague accusations on the tip line, but they still took note and their list of suspects was continuing to grow. There was, however, no real evidence to tie any of the accused to the cases, and typically unwitnessed murders are very difficult to solve. So the Springfield Police Department allowed for unlimited overtime hours. They called in all the experts in the regional area to assist with these cases. And FBI profilers even began to look into the cases to create a profile they believed to fit the killer. They indicated that he was likely a man that could easily blend into the community and be well-known and liked. Could move in and out of the community very easily. Fairly young, likely around 30, and they believed him to be African-American. They thought that he did some kind of precision or exact work, something that took a lot of attention to detail. and may appear normal or even boring to most people. They stated that he likely lived and worked not too far from the area and most likely did not live alone either. Now, serial killers often take souvenirs as a trophy of their killings. And while they were not sure if this was true in the case, they kept that in the back of their minds as they were processing all of the crime scenes and continued to keep that in mind during the investigation. Escalating fears within the community were building, and women were advised on the local media and news outlets to use extreme caution when going out in public, and were encouraged to travel in groups and not do solo outings. On February 11th, of 1998, just 9 days after Loretta's murder, the killer claimed another victim, 43-year-old Rosemary Downs. Her body was located in her home by her eldest son, who was going in to check on her. He called the police and let them in to investigate the crime scene, and they notated that there was no signs of forced entry and, again, no defensive wounds on her person. Rosemary was raped and strangled just like the other victims. And detectives were able to collect pieces of clothing that were in her room that also contained seminal fluids. This murder occurred less than half a mile from where Loretta's body was located. Investigators agreed with the FBI profiler and started to believe that this was an insider, someone very familiar with the community and the locations around town. He likely had easy access to the women and was someone they knew personally, since there was never any sign of the women attempting to fight the attack. Now, detectives began knocking door to door and following up on every lead they received on the tip line to get any kind of information they could to help them solve these cases. They located a man who was linked to two of the four victims. There was no forensic evidence that he had been to any of the crime scenes. It was just that he happened to know two of the victims. However, they followed him in an attempt to locate anything that might incriminate him or indicate that he was in any way guilty. But he...
like socks filled with semen.
Sir, where are your socks at? They followed him, but he cooperated with the police 100% and even submitted a DNA sample for them to test. He was not responsible for these crimes, and the detectives were then back to square one. The ever-frightened...
Oh, he wasn't responsible. His skeet
I don't
good.
Think he didn't give he skeet, skeet as the sample. He gave blood.
Yes, he... Oh, are you he sure he didn't give blood. Skeets? You know, sometimes blood and skeets
it's
don't
same
match.
DNA.
DNA. No, it's not. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes you're secretor, so that means your skeet and your saliva don't match.
That's
they're different
common.
DNAs.
But well, anyways, he gave blood. So I guess maybe okay. he was okay. guilty. But anyway, so they were back to square one. Now, the ever-frightened community began to arm themselves. Weapon sales were at a high during this time. And 8 days after, I'm not looking at you. 8 days after, I can see it in my breath. 8 days after Rosemary was murdered, Vicki Roberts was reported missing. Now, Vicki was a 37-year-old single mother who was last seen leaving her daughters with a babysitter for a night out with friends. And she was described as a good mom and somebody who would never have just deserted her children. So investigators were trying to determine, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, don't ever go out. That's the moral of the story is just
trust no
don't
one.
Ever go out. Don't go on a girl's night. Trust
not
no
one.
No date.
Investigators were trying to determine who Vicki went out with that night to get more information on what might have happened to her. And they began to question the family and friends looking for any information that could help them find her. The next day, Vicki's car showed up on the opposite side of the building where she lived and normally parked. There was blood inside the car, though not much. Okay, so detectives took a sample of the blood that was in the car, but they were not sure if it was the blood of Vicki or whoever grabbed her. Now, in the area that Vicki lived, there was heavily wooded area, and the police canvassed the area and searched throughout the woods to try to locate her, but they were unable to do so. During their investigation, they did, however, locate some of the people she was out with on the night that she was last seen, and they found out that she was in the company of a couple female friends and one male friend, and the male in question was identified as 31-year-old Alfred Gaynor. Now, not much is known about Alfred Gaynor's early life. He was born on December 10th of 1966 in Springfield, Massachusetts, where he lived the entirety of his life. He attended...
Hey, did you know my story took place in Springfield, Massachusetts?
No, I was like, no, it didn't. It was a different.
Did Did you know my story took place in Massachusetts? Oh my god, I didn't.
That's so weird that they're linked in that way. What a weeding.
Crazy.
Small world.
Okay, sorry.
He attended Roger L. Putnam High School, where he trained for a job as an auto mechanic. After high school, and without any formal continuing education, he was forced to seek employment in low-skill labor. And in the late 1980s, Alfred was able to master the skills needed to gain his dream job of working in an auto body repair shop.
What's considered a low-skilled labor?
Like handyman work.
That sometimes takes
more. Not like an electrician or a plumber, but like a...
Like,
I'm just saying, no. That's what it's called.
Okay.
So, however, he also still periodically worked as a day laborer on the side, even after working at an auto body shop, and typically would do small house repairs and other odd jobs for people. And at this time, he also developed a drug and alcohol addiction, and in the early 1990s began leading a marginalized lifestyle. So Gaynor was brought in for questioning as a person of interest, as he was the last known person to be seen with Vicky before her disappearance. Gaynor admitted that he had been with Vicky the night she disappeared, however stated that they separated when she wanted to go to a pawn shop to sell some of the earrings that she was wearing. The interview with the police lasted 7 hours, with Gaynor swearing that he had nothing to do with her disappearance, nor did he inflict any harm on Vicky or the other women detectives asked him about. Gaynor submitted a DNA sample giving blood, but again, because DNA test results took some time to come back and there was no evidence linking him to the crimes at that point, they had no probable cause to be able to keep him, and they had to let him go. However, the detectives knew that since the community was in such a panic, and they didn't want, if he happened to be guilty, to let him just walk on a technicality, they decided to begin an immediate 24/7 hidden surveillance on Alfred Gaynor. Okay, so everywhere he went, he was being followed and recorded, and each day went...
I always feel like somebody's watching me. I got no privacy.
Ooh. So as each day went by, the concern that Vicky was not alive and that they were just waiting for her dead body to turn up increased. Vicky Roberts was missing for approximately 3 weeks when her body was finally located in the south end of Springfield. There was a building in that area of town that was getting an inspection, and one of the inspectors was doing an exterior check of the building and located her body behind some shrubbery. She was frozen to the core from being outside in the elements. Now, her death was consistent with the other homicides, indicating that she was raped and manually strangled, and it appeared that she was likely killed elsewhere and her body was dumped at the final location. She was not wearing the earrings that she had been wearing when she left for the night. The same earrings that Gaynor stated she was on her way to pawn. So the 24/7 surveillance on Alfred continued, and they eventually spotted him visiting a pawn shop. And when detectives went inside, they were informed that he had pawned the earrings that Vicky was wearing that night. Now investigators finally thought that they had the proof they needed to indicate that Gaynor was their guy. And after reviewing the original FBI profile that was created, Gaynor checked all the boxes. He was an African-American male, 31 years of age. He lived with his parents. He was working in auto body and machining industry, which takes precision and attention to detail. He was well-known in the area, especially as he was a handyman on that side of town and would offer his services for many of the people within the community.
Hey, did you realize you've done 2 stories about Black serial killers? There's not like a ton that I know of. That
yeah, they're usually killers. Crazy white dudes.
And you've done 2.
And I have done 2 of them.
Well, yeah. Just saying that was interesting, that's all.
So now, on April 10th of 1998, Alfred Gaynor was arrested. His friends and family were shocked by the allegations that he could have been responsible for these crimes. And the detectives working the case continued to investigate up until the trial. They located palm and fingerprints at 2 of the 3 crime scenes. Blood was located at the Rosemary crime scene, and Gaynor's DNA matched samples taken at all of the crime scenes. There was no doubt in the police's mind that Gaynor was responsible for the killings. Now, when Gaynor was arraigned, mayhem ensued in the courtroom. Rosemary's oldest son, the one who located her deceased body, lost control and lunged over the barrier at Gaynor. He attacked him, punching him and slamming into him. He even ended up grabbing and hitting him with a chair, WWE style. Which is pretty dope. I saw the video and I was like, you go, boy. But he did get arrested.
Wait, you saw the video of what?
Bitch, did you not just listen to what I said?
Say it again? No, I did listen to what you said, but
you were just worried about me looking at you making faces. What'd I say?
He did a WWE style. So he fought them with the chairs, with the chair. And he did like a double Gaynor backflip. No, I'm just kidding. I was going to make some kind of Gaynor joke, but I didn't know what. And then I got all got thrown off because you said, I saw the video. And I was like, wait, what?
So during the arraignment, Rosemary's son, the one who found her body.
Oh, jumped over the, jumped over the, and then yes, jumped over the chaos, partitions.
And chair and WWE
I think I've seen that one too.
And I was like, yeah. So anyway.
I got confused. Sorry. I thought for some reason I was thinking a Gaynor did it. Like he WWE'd someone. That's why I was like, wait, what?
Awesome. But Rosemary's son did end up getting arrested. I don't think he probably spent much time in jail, but they did it for.
Did they drop the charges to try and dissuade other family members?
I don't know. I didn't look into it, but it was for essentially like impeding on the trial. The trial was an emotional one. Prosecutors described how Gaynor sought out women who were often alone and who knew him, and they would be comfortable with him, and he could take advantage of them.
Question, real quick. Were all his victims, what ethnicities were his victims? Black?
I didn't look into their ethnicities. I know some of them were black. I'm not sure if they all were. But they were all from, like, a low-income area.
Sorry. Low-income area. Okay.
And I did have, I was reading some stuff that was indicating that some of them were, like, drug users. So he wanted to be able to take advantage of them, and he struck with intense fury during the crimes. And then we just disappear back into the community. So Alfred Gaynor.
Boop. Where am I, bitches?
Alfred Gaynor was found guilty on all counts of first-degree murder as well as aggravated rape. And he was sentenced to life for each of those murder charges and a subsequent 25 years for each of the aggravated rape charges. It does not stop there, though. Gaynor is responsible for even more murders. Years later, in 2010, he confessed to killing an additional 5 women. Vera Hollams, 45, was found tied, beaten, and strangled in her apartment on April 20th of 1995. Amy Smith, 20, was found in her apartment on July 11th of 1996 with her 22-month-old daughter, Destiny Smith, who ended up dying of starvation in the apartment, starvation and dehydration in the apartment because obviously her deceased mother couldn't take care of her. Which is super sad.
You think someone would have heard the baby cry?
I mean, they checked. I don't know how long it took for the baby to pass away.
3 days, I think. If you don't have,
it could be sooner for babies because they're still developing. I don't know, but somebody did. They were like, "Hey, she has a baby. We haven't heard from her." And then the police went and found both of the bodies. So Jill Ann Ermolini, 34, was found in the cab of a truck in an auto body yard on June 16th of 1997. Robin Atkins, 29, was found strangled, bound, and gagged in a downtown alley on October 25th of 1997. And then Joanne Thomas, 38, was found in her home on November 1st of 1997. So Massachusetts does not have a death penalty. So unfortunately, Alfred Gaynor gets to continue to live his life. However, he will never spend any of that outside of a prison. And that is the story of Alfred Gaynor. Horrible human.
That's crazy. I'm trying to think if I've heard that one before. I think I have, because I think I've seen that video you're talking about.
Some of that shit pops up on YouTube all the time where it's like, look at this craziness in the courtroom. But anyways, we can see if we can post the video on our IG because it is worth the watch because that motherfucker deserved it.
Yeah.
As soon as he got the chair, I was like, that's amazing. That's hilarious. He was like, wah.
I wish they would, it's not funny, but it would be funny if they edited it with, like, the WWE announcers, like.
Or they're like, RKO out of nowhere. No?
No, I don't know that one.
You're not a true fan. Fake fan. Yo, fake fan.
Yeah, 100% fake fan now. Because it's all fake. Back in the day, it was not. Now it's fake.
I mean, it's all scripted, but it's not fake. They still hurt their bodies for real. They still get thrown for real.
But I just thought it was interesting because I did look up his picture towards the end because I wanted to see what he looked
like. I know.
Like. Because I was like, wait, I think he's black. Because you were saying like
I thought he was African-American.
Oh, well. But I wanted to see. And then I was like, oh, that's interesting that you've two of your stories and we've only done 8 each so far. Or no, this will be 9. And 2 of them happen to be...
I don't discriminate. And it was like more recent than some of the other stories we tell.
Yeah.
So a lot of the ones that we told so far are like either super old timey or like 70s and stuff.
Well, it's sad that the baby
late
died.
90s. That one was really sad to me.
That's really sad.
Yeah.
Stop biting my feet.
Sorry. I like feet. Do you want to hear a story? You guys want to hear a story about toes sucking? Just kidding. Oh, that was great.
Also, how do you have such an old man horse laugh?
I love it. I didn't used to have it. I don't know where the fuck it came from, but I ain't mad at it. It gets everybody laughing.
It sounds like you
everybody
smoke.
Enjoys it. It brings joy to the world. I do smoke. Not all the time.
Oh, well, whatever.
Anyways, thanks for listening to our stories this week.
Like and subscribe. Listen to our stories.
Follow us on the IG.
Comment on our things. Follow us on Instagram at suspicious_podcast.
And then we also have a Gmail account exclusively for our listeners to talk to us. It's suspicious@gmail.com.
You can send us your suggestions. You can send us
what was the song? It's a listener requested story.
Listener requested stories.
You want to hear it?
We want to say it. It's a listener requested story. Send it to us on our Gmail. Or you can message us on Instagram. We'll do it. Don't
send us money because we are poor.
No, then we have to have a Patreon. I don't want to do that.
So anyways, come back next time for more stories.
And we'll talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye.